okay, I got a Bible story, but then I have this idea that I want to connect to the Bible story. So in the Bible, you can read this in Esther, the first chapter and the second chapter. The book of Esther is about Esther, but more importantly, it's about God's sovereignty and his power and his commitment to his people. In the process of communicating this story about all those beautiful things, there is a subplot that takes place that positions Esther to save her people from an evil plot meant to destroy them. It's a beautiful story. It begins because the king, Ahasuerus, is a party boy, essentially. He's having a big party. He's showing off all of his riches. Kings did that. They fought in battles in the Bible, and they showed off their riches. They acquired riches as a result of successfully conquering other nations and taking the spoil to build wealth. That's the quick and dirty way of saying that they get rich on other folks. The wealth of a king, as time goes on in the Bible, is only as valuable as people are able to see it. And so, essentially, what makes a king wealthy is not just that he has a lot, but the beauty of what he has. So as the Bible begins to explain King Ahasuerus' wealth, it talks about all the linens and the wine and the fine jewelry, all these beautiful things. And the king throws this big party so that people can see the beautiful things that he has. One of the beautiful things that he has is the Queen Vashti. And after he has shown all of his glory, all of his riches, all of his stuff, he decides that he wants to show off his wife. Now, if you are a feminist, you probably need to study this story a little bit deeply. You need to understand the times for which this stage takes place. There's a lot to consider here. For the purposes of this podcast episode, Season with Salt, episode 179, we're going to assume that everybody is on the same page around why the queen is essentially considered a part of the king's riches. It was a part of the times. The Queen Vashti says that she is not going to respond to the king's request for her to come and be shown off. Now, the queen is also amidst hosting people. So in general, the king would host the men and the queen would host the women. The queen leaving her party to come to the king's party would technically be a little bit of a diversion for her because she is hosting just like he is. For whatever reason, reasons for which we do not necessarily know, the queen is unavailable. She's unavailable to fulfill the role in that day and time of what it meant to be queen. When the king has a review of her decision not to show herself to the people, not to present herself at the call of the king, there's a conversation about what should be done with her. And in that conversation, it's noted that she being a person of influence, she being the queen, she being someone that women look up to and follow, it's really important for her to be appropriately punished so that other women and other households don't think that it is appropriate to not respond to the man of your house. That's a story in a nutshell. That's how we get Esther, because King Ahasuerus gets rid of Vashti and needs a new queen, and Queen Esther goes through the process of becoming representation of God's favor in that particular kingdom and sparing her own family members as a part as a result of her position, but as a result of God's answer to her and her handmaiden's prayer. So what does that have to do with availability? Culturally, it was Vashti's responsibility to be available. But also, her availability presented her with an opportunity to assist her husband in operating in the vein for which kings operate. She was physically present. The place where she needed to be was accessible, but it was just not her thing. And so she didn't go. And that led me to this discussion in my mind around general availability. Sometimes we get in relationships with people who are not physically, spiritually, even naturally available. And depending on how old you are, people will tell you, specifically when you are a person of a certain age or a little older, people will tell you that it is important to make adjustments to your expectations because the older you get, the more difficult it is to secure a loving relationship. And so you've got to settle for some things that perhaps you would not have settled for in your 20s or so on and so forth. The reason why I picked King Ahasuerus in this particular story about Vashti is because I valued the fact that the king had a moment of confusion about what to do with a person for whom he's in a relationship with who appears to be unavailable. He has some questions about her availability that I think are interesting that he poses to the people around him. Because I'm sure that it's difficult for him to have viewed her behavior as just insubordination. Maybe there was another issue that came up. Maybe there was something that handicapped her from whatever it was. He had questions. And so he ran those questions by people in his camp only to see the detriment of her unavailability. He was able to see the detriment of her unavailability before she could be unavailable again, right? So he took no pleasure in the first time she was unavailable, and he essentially killed off a practice of being unavailable amongst not just the queen, but everyone who was influenced by the queen. And sometimes, as difficult as it is, particularly in relationships, you have to learn where to draw the line. When is enough enough? It's really important for us to draw a line in the sand with regard to what our expectations are for people to demonstrate emotional availability. And I pick emotional availability over physical or spiritual availability because I think that they all sort of pour into emotional availability. I went to a website called choosingtherapy.com, and I want to read a little bit of how they described emotional availability. Here's what they said. Emotional availability refers to the ability to share a healthy emotional connection, experience a wide range of emotions, both wanted and unwanted, and express them accurately and respond to your partner's emotions and emotional availability is the opposite. It involves difficulty expressing unavailability and handling emotions, struggling to get close to others, and the fear of commitment or intimacy. Now, this is what choosing therapy says. I did a little bit of research about how this manifests in relationships. So emotional availability manifests in a person's responsiveness, in a person's capacity or ability to show empathy, in a person's ability to participate in intimacy in whatever kind of way that is, in a person's openness, whether that be to share their own feelings or to explore different ideas with their partner, their capacity, ability to be sensitive or show sensitivity to issues, and then their emotional articulation, their ability to articulate emotions. So those are things that feed into a person's ability to be emotionally available. The challenge is gonna always be for the person who needs emotional availability, which I think is everybody, is going to be knowing when to yield to the possibility of love. I think Brandy has a one of her albums, she has a song called Fall. And it talks about like this idea of like fully embracing whatever it takes to be in an intimate relationship, right? And not being afraid to release yourself from the fear and anxiety of trying something new. Here's what choosing therapy says are 13 signs of emotionally unavailable people. And I'm saying people, they said partner. I like the word partner, but I don't know if I like it in the context of when I'm talking about relationships, because I think it dilutes, but that's neither here nor there. Choosing therapy says that there are 13 things that are signs that your partner or anyone is emotionally unavailable. Number one, they avoid commitment or labels. And this is important because sometimes people are really into the fantasy of relationships, but they haven't really explored within themselves whether they are willing to take the leap to actually be in a relationship. They know how they want to feel, they know what they want to do, but they are not positioning themselves to pursue successful interpersonal relationship with another person. So number one is they avoid commitment or labels. And labels are, you know, if you go to the grocery store, you don't have to wonder what the label is on something that you want to buy, because that label is front and center. It's for everybody to know. It's not a secret. So when people are avoiding labels, they're avoiding what it means to be attached to a label, the aftermath of being attached to that label, what people will say, what people will do, how people will respond, so on and so forth, what it means for them. There is an anxiety, and I've dealt with just the anxiety of navigating other people's responses to the decisions that I make. That can be very stressful, particularly if you're in families that are very tight-knit and so on and so forth. So something to consider. Number two, second thing that emotionally unavailable people do is they have very surface-level conversations. There is a fear of going deep, because going deep means that you are willing to be vulnerable to the extent that you share something with your partner that they need to know that they would not have known in the absence of going deep. That sounds like I said something in circles, but You know what I mean. Number three, they struggle to discuss their feelings. They have them, but they don't articulate them well. Number four, they don't ask you about your feelings. If they don't know how to talk about their feelings, then they surely don't know how to talk about yours. So it's an all-around struggle. The worst type of relationship you can be in is when the person is so committed to avoiding their own feelings that they don't even know how to participate in a conversation with you about yours. And sometimes men can be really guilty of that, right? It's like, I'm listening, say what you're gonna say. As a man, I've had some challenges with being forthright about my own feelings. And a lot of that is that sometimes our silence or not talking about something is our only way to protect us. It's our only way to protect ourselves, right? Because the more you become vulnerable, the less you are able to protect yourself. You share a deep, dark secret with somebody, they can weaponize that secret, right? And so you're vulnerable, you're naked, you're exposed. Number five, they struggle to empathize and respond when you share your feelings, right? They don't have any feelings. They struggle to communicate about their feelings. They don't necessarily want to hear about yours, so they don't ask. And then on top of that, there's an absence of empathy. You ever been talking to somebody and whether you articulate it with clarity or not, like you're lamenting about something that happened, an experience that you had, and you're talking to somebody that has zero ability to empathize, I'm sorry that happened to you, not a wow, nothing. They just are like, oh, okay. And then they move on with whatever they want to get across. That can be very dangerous. So that's one of the signs of a person that's emotionally unavailable. Number six, they're unclear about what they want from you or the relationship. Either they have the pleasure or the luxury of avoiding that conversation because you do, but they are not bringing it up, right? They're unclear about the direction that they want. And sometimes the idea of having to take a direction, pick a direction, be solidified in our decision-making sometimes makes us just want to not be in it at all, right? So there's that unclarity. There is the driving, being driven towards clarity can often be so overwhelming that it's just easier to just quit, right? Number seven, they say they can't trust you. So if a person is working harder to not trust you than they are to trust you, it could be that they have some commitment anxiety, right? But commitment anxiety might be another way of looking at what it means to be emotionally unavailable. But people who have an anxiety around commitment are generally looking for opportunities to be like, I'm out. Sorry, this is not going to work. They're inconsistent. Lots of highs and lows. Lots of hiding behind this concept of being moody. Are not able to communicate a consistent idea, a consistent identity, a consistent way of being. It's just all over the place. And sometimes, do you know that there are people, and you probably know somebody who thrives off of things being chaotic? Because as long as things are chaotic for people, then they can manage a certain narrative of control, right? Some people like chaos so that they can sneak under the radar when it comes to how they're seen or viewed in conflicts. So they're inconsistent. Number nine, you find yourself doing all the relationship work. And again, these things are in choosing therapy. I didn't make these up. I'm just telling y'all what the website said. You sometimes find yourself, you feel like you're doing all the work. And work is, of course, subjective because it's really around what you value, right? So if you feel like doing all, it could be that you're both available, but you feel like you're planning all the dates, or you're spending all the money, or you're coming up with all the ideas. Like, you're the one taking the initiative. You're the one that calls first. You're the one that texts first. Whatever that might be, you feel like you are doing all of the work. The inconsistent, you're doing all the work. Number 10, they get really defensive. When confronted, an emotionally available person tends to respond defensively versus just expressing their real and true emotions, right? And if you find yourself in a relationship with somebody and their go-to disposition is defensiveness, like, sometimes it's easy to plot your escape by trying to defend yourself or trying to be argumentative. And so you have to be careful of that attempt, because not only are they defensive, they're defensive because they're struggling to communicate, who they are and what their feelings are, and it's all bad. Number 11, they don't have a history of serious relationships. I mean, and that doesn't have to be necessarily intimate relationships. That could just be you're trying to build a friendship with someone and you notice that they don't have strong and consistent relationships with anybody. And not to be putting colors on flags, but that's a little bit of a red flag if you're trying to build something with somebody who doesn't have a reputable example of when they were able to at least prove that they could build something, right? Red flag. They don't introduce you to people in their lives. They're very reluctant about doing that. That's number 12. And then number 13, they tell you they're emotionally unavailable or aren't ready for a serious relationship, period. So I love what the protagonist in our text does. He weighs public opinion, I mean, good or bad, right? I mean, it can go either way. But he weighs public opinion and he determines that the response that he gets is correct, that he needs to get his own needs met. And it's not like the king and the queen interacted every day, but he needed to know that when he needed the queen, she would avail himself as a result of who she essentially signed up to be. And so he made a decision to best protect himself, to protect those that followed him. And he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get me a new queen. And I challenge everyone who is listening to think about areas in your life that you have a Vashti, but not an Esther. A Vashti is choosing to operate and move at their own pace rather than agreed upon pace. Vashti comes with a lot of reluctance and selfishness and self-centeredness, whereas an Esther is humble and understanding, and their heart is open, their ears are open, they are willing to explore whatever it is that they need to explore. And once you have identified the Vashtis in your life, it's important to make decisions accordingly, right? Like, it would not have made sense for the king to continue in a relationship that he knew he would not get his needs met in. Now, this is not about rushing to get a divorce or anything like that. This is simply about reconciling relationships that can go on and on and on and on without any true reflection, without any true sort of like moving to the balcony to look down on the relationship. because people tend to want to be in relationships for the wrong reasons. They want eye candy. They want to post it on Facebook. They want people to know that they're in a relationship, whatever the case might be. And sometimes the reason why you want to be in a relationship can handicap a good relationship. Like, you can have the wrong motives inside of a good relationship and it ruin it, right? Because you don't want what that other person wants, or you don't want what is productive. If you're just looking for eye candy, then you might get that, but you might not have peace in a relationship. You might not have joy, whatever it is. You have to be careful of that. I think that for people who have found themselves in relationships with emotionally unavailable people, need to take inventory of what they, or how they value their time, like how they value the resources that they have that nobody else controls except them and God. And availability is deeper than just answering the phone or responding to a text or setting up a date. Availability is deeper than that. And in our quest to be loved, to find love, to be connected with people, we can't overlook what it means to be in a soul tie emotionally. And, you know, Fantasia, she had that song, "If you don't want me, then don't talk to me." I should tell Alexa to play it right now, but I don't feel like it. Her little light came on. But if you find yourself regularly in relationships where other people in that relationship are emotionally unavailable, are they the problem or you? And I don't say that to get you in a position to, like, wanna bad mouth yourself, but to really jump into some thinking about what is the genesis of your need to be in these relationships, and what are the red flags that you experience early on, and you're like, oh my gosh, like, I'm overgiving, I'm overcommitting. I don't feel like I'm being reciprocated for what I'm doing. I think also you can have a standard for what you expect in a relationship, and you can be really committed to that standard. And it doesn't have to be a comparison of your last person with your new person. Sometimes our standards have to be established based on what it takes to completely meet our needs, and not comparing somebody to whoever else came along. I think that if God wanted us to be in relationships with people that weren't emotionally available, then he would have not taken a rib out of Adam's body to make Eve. He would not have said, "Men, I want you to love your wife as I love the church and gave myself." Like, we have this huge and beautiful and complex mandate to serve each other in intimacy, and emotional availability is everything, because you cannot serve somebody that's unavailable. You can't be a servant to someone when you are unavailable. So part of, like, correcting your heart is taking a real deep, beautiful look at the why of your decision. Why do I pursue this kind of person? Why am I unavailable? Why am I available? What makes me available? I think these are all good questions for us to ponder. I want to give a shout out to my friend Michael, because he told me that it's kind of funny. I think this is the way that he said it, or this might be the way that I experienced it. But he was like, "If you ever just want to, like, make your podcast be longer than 20 minutes, like, people will listen." So I guess this is my very long extended podcast episode. Anyway, I also been thinking a lot about, like, as a person who has been emotionally unavailable, I've thought about, like, just my process for, like, trying new things, stepping outside of the box. And one of the things that I have thought a lot about, because here's the reality, like, when you become, the more vulnerable you become, the more, like, you start second guessing, in a sense, like, if you're making the right decision. And sometimes your vulnerability will not pay off, and you will regret being open, because the outcome of your being open or vulnerable was not beneficial to you. You had a short relationship, and you opened up yourself in a way that you hadn't opened up to someone else. And then the relationship ends, and you're like, man, like, I told my business, or whatever it might be, or I tried to be more open than I have been in previous relationships. The thing that I think is important, well, first of all, prioritize healing for yourself that is beyond a person or a system. I used to work in HR, and I noticed a sort of a trend with people. They would be more interested in finding a new job when they had a conflict with their current supervisor. But you'd be talking to these people, and they never make any mention of how their qualifications have evolved or how they want to get paid more. It's always based on, like, a conflict. Well, not always, but in my experience, it was based on the conflict. And I always would tell people, like, if you can make an assessment of your worth and your value and what kind of contribution that you want to make career-wise, and let that guide your decision-making with regard to where you work and how often you change a job, you're going to be better off than making an emotional decision based on something that happened in a meeting or a relationship that you have with the current supervisor. And sometimes our healing, how we experience the world, is kind of like that. Like, it's an emotional response that sometimes gets us far, right? Like, maybe we have a bad experience, and as a result, we look for a job and we find one and we get out of that bad experience. Or we had a bad relationship, so we went to therapy and therapy helped us. Or, you know, like, something tragic in our lives led us to Jesus. Great, right? We're in a relationship with Jesus Christ. But nothing is going to equate to long-term, healthy healing than a commitment to pursuing that beyond a circumstance or a person, because people will put you through the same cycle over and over again if you let them. And it's your job to protect your own peace, your own stability, your own, it's your job to do that. And I just want to say that if you have, I know I'm all over the place, but hey, I want to say, if you have been vulnerable, and you're like, I tried it and it didn't work, and so now I'm going to close back up again, I want to challenge you to pursue complete healing for yourself. And then I want to challenge you to try again, because if you don't try again, you will never experience the fullness of the glory, the benefit, the beauty of, like, having a purely intimate and emotionally available experience with another human. And I think that God has ordained that for us, right? Like, I think he wants that for all of us. Otherwise, he would not have done it. And I know Paul said, you know, some people are called to singleness. Like, I have had seasons in my life where I'm like, yep, that's me. I've had other seasons where I'm like, okay, I need to have two kids and I need to be married. And I just, you know, I don't know what season I'm in now, but pray my strength. But yeah, like, pursue emotional availability, detach it from previous experiences to the best of your ability. If you need to go to therapy, go to therapy. Don't forsake prayer. Don't forsake the power of prayer to guide you into emotional and spiritual freedom, and trust God with the details of your interpersonal relationships. And don't leave him out of those. Like, don't feel like he's not invested or involved or interested in your pursuit of intimacy, because you need him to be the center of your relationship. You need him to be the center of whatever it is that you are doing. And then healing is always going to be a process. You ever thought you healed from something and then you run back into a person or a thing or a system, or you get triggered and you're like, oh my gosh. And so then you're just all in a disarray. Like, sometimes that happens, right? And you can't, you gotta be committed to saying, okay, I've been triggered. Like, what has this opened up for me that I still need to work on? Like, is there an area in my life that I just need to, like, step back? I didn't go on a vacation or a walk or a drive, or what is it that I need to do? Is I need to have a focused time of prayer around a certain issue, or like, what is it that I need to do? And then I love the scripture that tells us that his word is a lamp unto our feet, because essentially the more we pursue God through his word, the more he directs us and shows us what he wants us to do. And there's no area of our life that he's not concerned about. Right, there's nothing that we go through that he's like, I'm gonna leave that in the Dominique folder and I'm gonna take care of the rest. Like, he really, really cares. And because he cares, like, I don't know, I like talking to people that I think care. Because when you're talking to somebody who you know cares, like, you know, it feels different than somebody who's not really involved in a conversation that says they care. So he cares, period.